On Thursday, August 8th at 6 p.m. at the Eugene Art House, there was a special screening of the 2019 film Gaza Fights for Freedom, followed by a virtual Q&A with director and journalist Abby Martin. This documentary follows the peaceful Great March of Return, tells the story of Gaza past and present, and features riveting exclusive footage of demonstrations and rare archival footage that explains the history never acknowledged by mass media. Abby Martin is an American journalist, TV presenter, and activist. She helped found the citizen journalism website Media Roots and serves on the board of directors for the Media Freedom Foundation, which manages Project Censored. Martin appeared in the documentary film Project Censored, the movie, Ending the Reign of Junk Food News, and co-directed 99%, the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film. This is the Q&A from that event.
Thank you for joining us, coming from a protest. How did it go?
Yeah, classic.
Good. The film is incredible, and obviously a lot has happened since the Great March of Return, almost a year of Israeli genocide and the region on a knife's edge. I guess a good first question, and then we'll pass the mic around, is I guess you're very familiar with the region. Where do you see the situation right now, and where might we go from here, I guess?
Yeah, and let me know. You can hear me okay, right? I'm coming in.
Yep.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having this event. I think political education on this topic is obviously the most crucial thing that we could possibly do, because if not now, when? We're seeing Gaza obliterated before our very eyes. That placation of the two-state solution that we've been force-fed for the last 30 years has just been an impossible lie, only told to Western audiences to subsidize this atrocious apartheid state. You know, I want to mention a couple key characters in the film and what happened to them. And I'm going to try not to cry as I talk about it because it's very emotional. Maz Mwaza, the lead videographer from Gaza Fights for Freedom, two of his brothers were murdered. It took him 6 weeks to retrieve his brothers' bodies because snipers were perched up shooting anyone that tried to dig through the rubble. So just imagine waiting 6 weeks and then digging through rubble and finding your dead sibling's body to have a proper burial. The home that his family built with his bare hands was completely annihilated. It looked like a nuclear bomb was dropped in the area. There wasn't one shred of anything left from his entire life, including his entire extended family. I have no idea where he is. I haven't been able to talk to him for several weeks. Kareem, who was the field producer, he was displaced three times. His wife was pregnant. She found out she was pregnant as the genocide started. So just imagine going through this whole thing with no water, no real nutrition, caring for two small children while knowing that you're pregnant the whole time. Luckily, we were able to do a GoFundMe for him and Waz, and we raised $80,000. And so finally, Kareem was able to get out of Gaza, and they're safely in Egypt now. But just the travesty of having to raise tens of thousands of dollars, have people flee a genocide, this is unprecedented. It's an unprecedented situation to cage people, indiscriminately bomb them, and not let them flee, and to put these enormous price tags on their head. Now, Ahmed Abu Artema, the lead organizer of the Great March of Return, his house was targeted in a direct targeted strike, because we know from Israeli intelligence, who boasted to 972 Mag, that they know who's in every house. They know who's in every house. They know every seven-year-old child. I'm quoting them verbatim. They know if a seven-year-old child is in the house, and that's necessary collateral damage for them. So all of the deaths, all of the people who are doctors and surgeons and alongside their entire families and all of the journalists, a lot of these are targeted. And so, of course, I mean, Ahmed Artema, he's responsible for this huge, massive, nonviolent action. Of course they targeted him. He was in the hospital with second-degree burns with his two children for months. His 10-year-old son was murdered in that strike. And the last I talked to him, he just said, just keep protest. I mean, what do you even say? What do you even say? And so that's where everyone's at. You know, I have no idea where the other Ozma, the female videographer, I have no idea. I haven't been able to contact her this entire time. Everyone suffered. Everyone is going through hell. It's absolutely unfathomable that we've watched this for 11 months straight. You know, when we made the movie, relying on international law and this UN report and just kind of this event in general as a vehicle to educate people about how brazen Israel is in committing war crimes. And I thought, you know, if everyone knew, if everyone could just see with their own eyes the war crimes in broad daylight, surely there could be no plausible deniability about Hamas human shields and every few years these mowing the lawn operations that the IDF does in Gaza. Surely everyone would know and change their mind, right? Well, we know that didn't happen, right? But we know now. You know, I thought that at that point it was the craziest thing Israel had ever done. And, you know, I think that bar has been set to a level that I don't think any of us could have ever fathomed at this point. You know, at the beginning of the genocide, the amount of people that were killed during the Great March of Return were dying in single airstrikes. They were bombing hundreds of people a day. Dozens of Palestinians are still getting killed every day. I mean, it's beyond comprehension, honestly. It really is that this is normalized, the rapidity of war crimes, the succession, that successive nature of everyday heinous atrocities, and they just keep compounding. And I fear a world that this is normalized. I fear a world where Israel's allowed impunity. What kind of world is that we're entering into? If Israel can get away with this, what's next? What is next? But at the same time, we have to be inspired and hopeful at the growing resurgence of a new international solidarity movement with Palestinian liberation at the forefront and anti-imperialism at the background. And that's a beautiful thing. I haven't seen that. I mean, we haven't seen something like that because our movement's been co-opted and defanged and whitewashed for so long. And so what we see today, tens of millions of people on the streets linking these struggles together that have no connection really to Palestine, but they understand how these things connect. That international solidarity is beautiful and it's growing, and they can't take that away from us because the dam has broken. And now Israel is an apartheid state committing genocide under the international court system. And that's never going away. And no matter what happens with Kamala and Waltz and with the ICJ case, they will never take that from us. They can never dominate the narrative again. They can never put us on the defense ever again. They're going to be on the defense, and so are the apartheid and genocide apologists and defenders. They're going to have to explain their position. So the tide has changed. It's now making apartheid fall, building that mass movement, building the momentum, and continuing to make it grow despite the obstacles and hurdles ahead. And all of those obstacles are only in place because they anticipated the tide of justice that they knew was inevitable. And it's not going away.
Abby, first of all, what an truly, it's ineffable what you have done and what you have brought forth to the world. So thank you. Thank you. And my question is, how can we get this as wide of an audience as possible? Streaming, showing everywhere. Where is it presently available and viewable, and where has it yet to be shown?
Thank you. Thank you so much for those kind words. You know, there's no shortage of Palestine films, that's for sure, right? It seems like every year there's two and they're circulating through the international film circuit, and they go, you know, they're on our TV screens. I remember when we made this film, there were two, when I was flying back from a trip at the time that we were creating this, and I remember there was two Palestine films in the plane, and I was like, wow, this there's a lot of oversaturation of this issue, but what's the problem? The overcomplication, right? That attempt to both sides a very clear-cut issue. Probably the most simple, clear-cut issue in the world today. and so that has been just a travesty. The amount of time and effort and money and artistic creative output and overcomplicating what should be a very straightforward narrative. And unfortunately, that's led us to the position that we're in today, where people saw Israel as a leftist project because of the persecution of Jewish people historically. I mean, it's shocking and so just counterintuitive to the nature of what Israel exists to do, right? It's a growing settler colony. I mean, it exists to colonize another people. It's planted on top of another people, and it's predicated on the continuous expulsion of those native inhabitants. And so the trick, the greatest trick in the book is pretending that those are the victims, right? So it's been quite unfortunate to see this oversaturation of the issue in popular culture and told in such a wrong way. And so long story short, that's why we wanted to make this movie, because it was unapologetic in the pro-Palestine viewpoint. For at least one of the only, I mean, I'm sure there's other films that are very unapologetically pro-Palestine, but this was the first one that I, you know, especially about this chapter, let the Palestinians dictate how they want to be viewed. All we see are Palestinians dark in the shadows. I remember it was, I forget what mainstream channel did a documentary about the Great March of Return. The Palestinians were sitting in this dark room in this sinister light. You know, and of course they found the most extreme person saying this, that, or the other. I mean, it was just disgusting. And so, you know, putting Palestinians in the light that they want to be shown in, that they love, that they love. I remember when I was first talking to the Palestinians in Gaza about doing this project, and they said, Abby, how do we convince Americans that we love life? And I want you to think about that for a second, because that's actually what Americans think, is that Palestinians love death. And how disgraceful is that? How disgraceful is that level of dehumanization, that human beings are unworthy of life because they don't love life? And to actually, it sounds so ridiculous, but the fact that they were genuinely asking, how do we show people that we want to live, that we love our children, you know? And it's just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking that you see people who tout themselves as liberals, like Sam Harris, saying that they're a death cult. You know what? They love life more than those people will ever even understand what life is, because they know how fleeting it is. They know that they could lose it at any second. You don't understand, and you can't possibly love life until you know how valuable it is. And so that's why we did the movie, and I'm so grateful to work with those Palestinian journalists that are unmatched in their bravery and courage and resilience. At this moment in time, it's available on YouTube. It's freely available on YouTube. On Vimeo, if you go to GazaFightsForFreedom.com, you can see it in a ton of different languages. It's available to watch there in an international audience. And it also is getting actually picked up for distribution, finally, by Watermelon Pictures. It's a new distribution company that's trying to uplift the voices of filmmakers who are telling these stories, uplifting Palestinian voices. And so I'm excited to see where it goes. I think the time is ripe. Even though it's an older documentary by a couple of years, it's still very timely. And that's what we tried to do with our approach, is, you know, this is a time capsule, but it also provides you the historical context that you need to know about the situation. It's kind of a lesson. I mean, it's something that anyone can watch at any time. And that's what we wanted to do. That was our goal, is that, you know, 10, 20, 50 years from now, it still matters. And it still can serve as a piece of education. And we're very proud of it. But yeah, I encourage any, I mean, I've talked to so many Israelis who have watched it that said it changed their mind. I mean, it's a powerful piece because you can't argue with it. You just see it. If you support a kid getting shot in the head for throwing a rock, well, then we can't help you. But if you care about anything, if you have empathy, if you're not a sociopath, then that will move you undoubtedly. And it just takes people seeing it, you know, seeing that dehumanization on the side of the Israelis. Finally, when the video camera gets turned around and you see who are the people that are pulling the trigger. Oh, they're celebrating killing kids. You know, it's hard to wrap your mind around it. I think at the time when this movie came out, people were absolutely horrified at that specifically. I think now we see videos every day of that kind of depraved, sadistic, ritualistic celebration of violence and barbarism. But at that time, it was really hard for people to wrap their mind around that. And they kept saying, how did you get that footage? And I said, Israelis released that themselves. They are proud. They hunt kids for sport. And they put that out there because they know there's no accountability. Why not? When you're that deep into this and you know you're shrouded with impunity from the most powerful empire in the world, this is the inevitability of that. This is the inevitability of that genocide. Genocide.
Hey, Abby, I'm Justin. Hey, I've admired your work for a while now, and thank you for giving a voice to the Palestinians. But, you know, a little time has passed since you made this film. I'm just wondering if there's anything you've learned in the time since you made the film, like maybe you wish you knew then that what you know now, or anything you would have liked to have included in the film in hindsight.
You know, No, I think, you know, of course you're going to have like self-criticism when you watch a film like 300 times like I have, and it moves me every time. And I think, no, I think I'm happy we focused on Razan. And I think it was important to kind of go from those broader statistics and then honing in on these are actual people. And so I think, you know, I've learned so much, mostly kind of backing up what I said 15 years ago that got me into a lot of trouble by comparing Israel to Nazi Germany. I mean, I was one of the first people out there, unabashedly so, in the mainstream media, or I guess if you could call RT mainstream back then. But it caused a lot of ire and upset. And I was the target of a lot of campaigns on behalf of the Israeli lobby and a lot of attempts to basically get me off of Joe Rogan's platform and RT and canceled at speaking gigs and stuff like that. And so I feel validated now that I called Israeli society fascist, unforgivably, irredeemably fascist. And that was based on a lot of investigative research and just on the ground insight that I gleaned. And, you know, we kind of didn't even touch upon that really in the film, but I think now, like, approaching the situation now, I mean, it's so surreal. I feel like I hope the story is told correctly now, which is how did we let this happen? And how did Israeli society become this way? Because certainly no one, you know, there's going to be plenty of documentaries, I think, about the genocide. And I don't think anyone's going to tell that side of the story because they're scared to. I don't think anyone's going to show what Israeli society really is and how they did this and how the writing was on the wall for so long and ignored and how these institutions failed us and the Palestinian people and how unparalleled and atrocious this is. And I hope someone does it right because the Palestinians deserve at least that.
I really want to give my appreciation to the organizers of this event. They're very courageous, and they're up against a lot of opposition, as you can imagine. And I also want to thank you and your husband, Michael, for all the work you've done all these years. I just want to thank you. One thing that that's very disturbing to me is it's very important when we talk with people, not here but elsewhere, the difference between Judaism and Zionism. Zionism is a supremacist political ideology. And yet, when I watch a film like this, I know that Hillel recruits young Jewish students from our universities to join the IDF and to go to Israel and to join the IDF. They promote the IDF. And it could very well be American Jews that are doing what we're seeing here. And that needs to be resisted. We have to find ways to resist Hillel's promotion of birthright Israel and the IDF. That's my opinion. But anyway, thank you.
I mean, it's a crucial point, and I think, again, that sea change of having young Jews, or not just young, I mean, Jews in general, be at amassing such a groundswell and amassing such an important part of the contingent of pro-Palestine liberation today just completely debunks that entire narrative that we've been force-fed. That you have to be on the defense and somehow explain why criticizing a state is not anti-Semitic, a government committing atrocities, maintaining a brutal military dictatorship, a fascist dictatorship, subjugating millions of people under the boot of oppression. No, that's not anti-Semitic. We're actually pro-human rights. We're pro-liberation. And so I think it's just that we have to be unafraid and we have to be confident in our viewpoint that we are right. We are right. We're on the right side of history. They're on the wrong side of history. And Jews are waking up everywhere, everywhere. And it's incredibly beautiful to see that. It's incredibly inspiring and beautiful because that's really all Israel has. They wouldn't spend billions of dollars trying to correct the record and maintain control over this falsehood that somehow Israel represents Jews. Certainly not my Jewish brothers and sisters. No, Israel's an aberration. Israel actually makes Jews unsafe. It's making the world unstable, especially for Jewish people, and it is a disgrace. But yeah, I think that political education, that Zionism is certainly not synonymous with Judaism. And look no further than the Christian evangelical movement here in the U.S. They're the strongest, most fervent, ardent supporters of Zionism. Biden infamously, you don't have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. I mean, he was one of the most unapologetic Zionists in Congress decades ago on the House floor, saying if Israel didn't exist, we would need to create her to serve our interests. So it's pretty laid bare, and I think it's just a matter of education because, again, the brainwashing is so steeped. And so it's just unpacking that. And I think, look, the time is ripe, and that's why events like these and just opening that space, if, you know, obviously we don't want to waste our time on racists or people who are cheering this on, because I think if you're cheering on the mass murder of children, there's no helping you. But I think the people who are still confused and maybe they don't understand what's happening because of how many lies they're getting barraged with, that's where we have to come in and provide that space and be open to helping people on their journey.
Okay, yeah, I just thought it was sickening when they had standing ovation after standing ovation for Netanyahu. I couldn't even believe that. And even someone as mainstream as Nancy Pelosi didn't show up, and I still haven't been able to find out how two of our, one of our congressmen and senator, what they did during that. But, and then just yesterday, we saw where Cori Bush was defeated by a huge AIPAC fund. And then we saw today, I heard on NPR, which is actually doing a good job for a change, about some prisoner who was so anally penetrated that they had to take him to the hospital, and they tried to tell lies about it. But my question is, and it's kind of the big question, it seemed like I've always heard that the Mossad was much more advanced than even the CIA. And I have to wonder, and they were getting warnings from the Americans, and they were getting warnings from Egypt. Was this a planned thing, this whole October 7th? I know that's a big conjecture question.
No, I'm ready to dive in. So first of all, the fact that literally Hitler 2.0 got invited to Congress. Let us not forget that the last time this war criminal came was to actually usurp and undermine Obama. It was actually like a counter to a sitting president who dared to just simply criticize like some sort of annexation that was happening at the time. So that's how powerful and entitled Israel feels that they are, that they can come and actually undermine a sitting U.S. president. And at that time, you know, he only got about 28 standing ovations, but they did a lot better this time, didn't they? They really clapped like seals for that motherfucker. It was like, you know, 58 times out of a 55-minute speech. Why did they even sit down at all? They should have just all stood up and just, I mean, it truly was one of the most horrifying things I have ever seen in my life. My blood was boiling. I thought, who are these monsters? They don't represent me. These people are demons. I mean, it was sick. It's honestly sick. And then Rashida's censored, you know, for daring to just say, I have the right to live, like my people have the right to live. I mean, you just cannot believe what's happening. But look at what AIPAC does. They just ousted two of a handful of Congress people that dared to call for a ceasefire. The most basic, meager political statement you can make 10 months into a genocide. And they still ousted them. They poured $20 million into these races to oust them, to put in AIPAC puppets. So I hope everyone's paying attention. I hope everyone's paying attention, because this is the new world that we live in. There are, you know, all of this hype and the memes and all of the vibes around Kamala and Waltz. You know, we can't let them co-opt this. We cannot let them co-opt this, because that's what they do. October 7th, let's talk about it. I mean, you know, you have to wonder, how is it that Israel is the surveillance capital of the planet? How is it that they have a surveillance grid across every square inch of Gaza, that they know, admittedly, who's in every building, and yet they just had no idea. They just had no idea that October 7th was coming. Well, we know from documents that came out a couple months ago that, yes, they knew. In fact, they knew the details of the hostages that they planned on taking. Down to the very number, they knew exactly where they were going to break in. And the Gaza division of the IDF actually came across such a huge amount of warnings and specifications about the attack that they were begging their commanders to not hold the Nova Festival. Why would you hold this festival if we have these? Nope, they were overridden. No. Hold the festival. Hold the festival. So you tell me, you know, without me having to say it, what does that mean? What does that mean? So, you know, similarly to 9/11, it kind of just seems a little bit too good to be true that they were just gifted this attack, a pretense to carry out a goal that we knew that they wanted all along, to retake and recolonize Gaza. Never was about the hostages. It's not about anything except taking the land that they think is theirs. And the only thing that this gave them carte blanche to do was just mass murder and just go on a serial killer shooting spree. It honestly feels like watching like a mass shooter for 10 months straight take people off one by one, and you're just watching and there's nothing you can do. And worse than Uvalde, where the police don't not intervene. They're arming. They're giving the ammo out. And the world is just like, how is this real? How is this our reality? So yeah, I think October 7th was a gift. And that's all I'll say about it. But I think, you know, I think the evidence speaks for itself. Yes, you said the families know? Totally. And the families of the hostages are out there trying to block freeways. Netanyahu's totally given up on a hostage exchange. He couldn't give it less of an F. He's trying to start war with Lebanon and Iran. He's like, this is my moment. Let's go. I mean, and let's not just pin this all on Netanyahu. I mean, we're talking about the entire government here. As we've seen laid bare, like everyone at the top is pretty much openly inciting genocide. And it's really unashamed. But yeah, I mean, they've totally let go of the idea of bring them home. Again, it's like they're honest. Western leaders, politicians, and media professionals, they're the ones who are lying and trying to placate us because they know that they need us to subsidize the state.
Great work, Abby. Listen, I've heard recently that Israelis are clearing out. They're going back to Brooklyn and Europe. And I'm wondering what you've heard about that.
I'm so sorry. Can you repeat the question on a again?
Well, I had heard recently that there's hundreds or thousands of Israelis are going back to Brooklyn or Europe, wherever they came from. And I'm wondering what news you have about that.
Right. I mean, would you want to be there?
No, absolutely not.
I wouldn't. I don't want to get
it's
the hell
out of
there.
It's a psychopathic hellhole.
I think any rational-minded Israeli, first of all, the fact that they're literally agitating regional war with like on multiple fronts is probably one impetus for this mass exodus. Like, I would imagine people, because a lot of Israelis have duals. I mean, they're dual citizens, right? Like, that's the whole point of this settler colony project. It's like, come to Israel. If you have any lineage that you're Jewish, like, come and just live here and become a citizen. So a lot of people have dual citizenship and they can leave. And so they're choosing to leave. Now, I don't know what political significance that has because I don't know if it is political or if it's just out of self-preservation. Like, I just don't want to be here right now because I don't want to get killed. But I'm hoping that there's some sort of political significance of the lesser fascist Israelis are realizing that they don't want to be there. You know, I think there has to be some percentage of people who are like, hey, this is, you know, I'm seeing the truth for the first time. I'm, you know, it must be a very, really, really tough and complicated process of unlearning Zionism if you're born and bred into the system as an Israeli. I feel less bad for the settlers who just go over there as like 20-year-olds for Aliyah or whatever. I mean, I feel bad for Israelis who literally are, you know, from cradle to grave, you're indoctrinated. And so that's a really tough process. But for, yeah, people who are floating over there at like my age, I mean, it's crazy. Who the hell would ever do that? So, you know, I think tourism has plummeted for obvious reasons. I think that we're going to see it's the beginning of the end. Birthright is certainly not looked at the same way with the films like Israelism and things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's naming and shaming now, and it's up to us to kind of create that cultural boycott for artists, musicians, the academic boycott for intellectuals and academics who are going on speaking tours there, sports boycotts. And that's why I think BDS is so crucial, because there's no hope from within Israeli society to change this. It's just becoming more encased and enclosed in its own fascism. And it's so genocidal now that even people who disagree are terrified to speak out because of the laws. I mean, if you're speaking out on social media, you could get arrested. I mean, it really is like very fascist now, with the new rollout of laws basically impeding people from just protesting and speaking out against this war. And so, you know, we don't really know, but sadly, we know how many people support it in polling, and it doesn't look good. So again, it has to come down to BDS, because there's no hope within a society like that to stop their own government. Yes, so I sued the state of Georgia. I'm one of the plaintiffs that tried to overturn the anti-BDS laws here that exist in almost every state now, certainly more than half. And again, you know, again, it's a multi-pronged attack that was preempted because they knew the inevitability of the movement. And so they preempted. And because of the runaway train and the power and subsidization of like the lobby and Israel from as an extension of U.S. empire, the lobby has become a runaway train and actually come back to roost and undermine our democratic rights in this country. So literally undermining our First Amendment right, our ability to have free speech, and our ability to politically boycott foreign governments that are perpetrating atrocities. And it's fascinating, actually, how that has played out. My case in Georgia, really quick story. The judge initially ruled in my favor, right? Because how could you not? It's like, yeah, certainly that's a violation of the First Amendment if you're not able to, you know, going back to the Montgomery bus boycotts, this was an enshrined protection by the Supreme Court. And then, fascinatingly, an Israeli government official came to the Georgia state legislature and lobbied for them to change the law instead of overturn the law and rule in my favor and actually make the law completely thrown out. They lobbied, hey, let's up the amount to $100,000. So basically it was if an independent contractor's contracted with $1,000 in any one of these states, they have to sign a pledge that basically fealty oath to Israel. Like, I will never boycott the state of Israel in order to get federal funds or state funds rather. And so of course I said, I'm not gonna sign that. That's insane. And so they changed the law to make it render my case moot and up that cap to $100,000. And so it was bizarre. It was like, wait, but the principle still stands because you can't put a price tag on free speech. So essentially the ruling still is in my favor on principle, but Israel and their lobbyists somehow circumvented that and still kept the law in the books by upping the cap. And so it's just an insidious way to just declare victory, even though they didn't really win. And so they've done that in another state, but there's been mixed rulings across the board. And so I was worried and hopeful for the Supreme Court to take it on, and they actually declined. They declined to hear and cast a final verdict on anti-BDS laws. I don't really have hope given the stacked nature of the Supreme Court, but I was certainly hoping that, you know, people who are trained in law would realize how insane it was. So yeah, it was fascinating that they just declined to hear it. And I don't know if there's going to be a final ruling or not, but more people need to take this on because this affects everyone. You know, this affects everyone. It has a deep chilling. And this is substitute teachers, state contractors who are just simply doing like hurricane. I mean, it's totally.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Abby. I remember back being asked to sign one of those anti-BDS things when I was working for a nonprofit, and I was like, yeah, that's not happening. So figure that out. That's not my problem. I have a two-part question for you because I can't pick which one I want to ask. My first one is that I saw a very impactful video from you that I shared with many people that I think is really important in this political moment about why you choose to and why you stand by your decision to never condemn Hamas. And I think that's really important. And then secondly, and very appropriately based on where you were at earlier today, just wanting, you know, you are a very, I really respect and admire your work and including your work on Venezuela. And so just wanting to hear your perspective on the recent election and the coup attempt underway. So two-part question, two for one.
Yeah, it's very important actually, because again, like this is a multi-pronged battle, and even the Communist Party in Palestine issued a statement in support of Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution in the wake of that election. I'm gonna answer the first question first, because this is a trap that a lot of people are fall prey to. And unfortunately, you know, for far too long, I'm just speaking in the proverbial we have let the oppressor dictate the barriers of our discourse and the barriers of our slogans and our language. And it is horrific to be told and policed, no, you can't say Free Palestine, because that has too many implications. Oh, that could mean this. It could be construed as this. So just temper that, tame that. I don't know, you can't say from the river to the sea because it could have genocide, even though the Likudnik Charter explicitly states from the river to the sea in a genocidal manner. No. Too much. Don't say that. Don't say this. How disgraceful is that, right? That we've allowed ourselves to be pacified, that we've gone so far from what liberation actually means. It's not pretty. It's not pretty. It can be a violent process. And that is precisely why international law has given the legal right of armed resistance. That's not me, that's the law. So when it comes to Hamas, there's two things that I want to say. One, I don't cede ground to condemning Hamas, even though I disagree with obviously killing civilians. I completely am abhorred by that. I will never condemn Hamas because this question is designed to delegitimize the opposition to these things. Similarly, like we saw during Iraq, all of the left, all of the anti-war movement, do you condemn Saddam? Do you condemn Saddam? Do you condemn Gaddafi? Do you condemn Assad? Do you condemn Maduro? Do you condemn Fidel? And when you fall prey to that, you're giving them way too much room to delegitimize then you opposing intervention, war, bombing, sanctions. Already they've won. Another design and trick rhetorically is to split the resistance movement, right? Again, dictating to us what is allowed, right? We're only allowed to grieve. We're only allowed to have certain feelings and certain rhetoric and certain language about October 7th and subsequently, you know, the civilians that are slaughtered in Gaza. You have to preempt anything about Gaza with, of course I condemn what happened on October 7th. Of course I condemn Hamas. Now will you allow me to criticize Israel? We should never do that. Because it's designed to split. It's designed to factionalize us. And I will never, never condemn a resistance movement that is fighting for their existence, the existence of their people. They are the only ones standing in between Palestinians and mass graves. So no, I'm not going to condemn the people who are keeping Palestinians alive. How dare you? How dare you? So that's my first point. The second point about Venezuela, you know, this is a battle of imperialism. You can't look at Palestine in a vacuum without understanding all of the other so-called adversaries of U.S. empire and all of the other countries that are under the boot and in the crosshairs of the United States. And Venezuela has been for 25 years. Why is that? Why is that? Well, they have the largest oil reserves in the world. That's probably first and foremost. It doesn't help that they elected a popular leftist leader on a popular mandate of nationalizing all of their services and providing a big mobilization for poor and working class Venezuelans when Hugo Chavez got elected. So we've seen, oh God, how many coup attempts now? Six? It's a bipartisan policy. It transcends administrations and politicians. And that's how foreign policy works. And so what you just saw, and again, I think a lot of people are confused, rightly so, because the media lies. AP, I just saw AP, CNN, BBC, Guardian. I mean, it doesn't matter what, you know, side of the political spectrum, liberal or conservative, it's all the same. Maduro's an autocrat. He's a tyrant. He committed fraud. He's a dictator. He killed all the protesters. That was a funny one. You know, I went to Venezuela in 2017. It was the height of the deadliest protests in Venezuela. And I embedded myself in the riots. And I risked my life because I honestly was victim to the propaganda as well. I went there wanting to learn with my own eyes. I thought, I believed some of it because I just didn't know better. And I think a lot of well-intentioned people do fall prey to propaganda because they don't know. Why would we know anything about Venezuela? How would you know anything about Venezuela? So I beg people, instead of thinking that you know something about Venezuela, remind yourself that the same media that has been lying about Palestine 10 months is also lying about Venezuela. And, you know, they have elections every 6 years. And their elections were heralded by Jimmy Carter back 20 years ago as some of the most rigorous, transparent, robust elections in the entire world. They have hundreds of international observers that observe these elections every time because they know weeks in advance the opposition is going to declare fraud and they're going to decry to Israel and the United States and beg for U.S. intervention. And that's exactly what happened. There's no proof presented and the corporate media just goes along with it. And I'll just leave you with one thought. Of course, there's a political diversity. Of course, it's not a monoculture. Not everyone's Chavismo and not everyone's a socialist. No one claims that. That's why Maduro barely eked by. He won 51% of the vote. That's not a mandate. People are suffering. 7 million Venezuelans have left. The economy was in free fall for years. There's real suffering, real hardships. The problem is that the opposition tries to erase the millions of Bolivarian revolutionaries and Chavismos and Venezuelans who support this project. They try to erase them and they want to privatize the oil. That's what came out from Gonzalez's platform, the opposition candidate who's backed by the U.S. Their first plan of action, privatize the oil and gas, privatize all the housing. So yes, there's political diversity. The Communist Party split recently. There's 10 other political parties, but really the opposition that's backed by the U.S. is far right. And they got 44% of the vote. And they were begging Israel to actually invade Venezuela back in 2019. Maria, I forget her last name. She's the head of the party. She wasn't the presidential candidate, but she's the head of the party. And she was literally, they fly Israeli flags. Because this is, again, it's like there's not only an international anti-imperialist movement that's very pro-Palestine and Maduro. You know, he's wearing a keffiyeh when he voted and he said free Palestine. You know, it's not just that. It's also Zionism. When you're looking at the international reactionaries, that globalized, very, very strong core of the right wing who are very mobilized. Zionism's very core, part and parcel with that. That's why you see Bolsonaritos or whatever the Bolsonaros fans waving Israeli flags too, because it's become a rallying cry for fascists. So yeah, I think all you need to know really is what the opposition stands for. And that's, you know, it really is revealed, I think, with begging Israel to invade. Oh, you guys, I wish I came in person. I wish I could have met all you guys, and I hope I can soon. You guys are so beautiful. You inspire me. Free Palestine, free Gaza. Keep it up, you guys. Woo! Keep up the good work, y'all.
number one, I think. I'm glad Tony plugged in.
Yeah!
It took hours and hours and hours. By the time I was done with it, I was so bored, I didn't know what to think. I carried him on with me for days and days. Playing little games. Like, not looking at it for a whole day and then looking at it to see if I still like it. No matter how I break it down,